Thank you to Cash App for sponsoring this episode.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening.
Maggie Freeling is an advocate, award-winning journalist, and producer reporting on wrongful convictions, the criminal legal system, and social issues. She is the host and producer of the Pulitzer Prize-winning podcast Suave on PRX, as well as the host and producer of the Signal and Anthem award-winning podcast Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. She also hosts Up and Vanished weekly podcast and is here to share about her newest release, Bone Valley Season 3, entitled Graves County, as well as about her work across all genres of storytelling. The Broken Cycle Media team is extremely grateful for this illuminating conversation and for Maggie's expertise and advocacy.
My name is Maggie Freeling. I'm a Pulitzer-winning journalist and producer. I'm also an adjunct professor, I'm a mentor, and I'm a three-time cat mom at the moment. I ask my mom a lot, why am I like this? Was I one of those kids that was always wondering about everything? Because that's me now, like my brain just doesn't turn off. And she was like, no, you just talked a lot. I just had a lot to say all the time. According to my mother, that goes back to me being 2 years old, having full conversations with adults, never wanting to be with the kids, just really being an obnoxious child that needed to know everything. I went to undergrad for English, and what do you do with an English career? You guys should become an English teacher. I don't know. I have a history of teachers and professors in my family, and my mother is a lifelong high school teacher and just said, don't be a teacher. It is one of the most difficult jobs in this country to do. I very quickly knew I wanted to do journalism because what I was looking for in English was journalism, because when taking like poetry classes and writing creative fiction, I was like, this is not what I want to be doing at all. I liked a lot of the literature I was reading because it was historical. I was in Victorian novel classes. I just wasn't interested in this fake world. I wanted to live in the real world, and that turned out to be news. So very quickly, I transferred to journalism and I got a double major in English and journalism. I just fell in love. I was traveling. I was meeting people. I was totally immersed in this new world. There was a point in my journalism career in my master's program where I took an opinion writing class. And I think that really solidified this difference for me, or not mutually exclusive type of journalism where you can't be an advocate and a journalist at the same time. I think I found that I had very strong opinions about things, which goes back to my childhood. I think that's when I learned I could be an advocate and a journalist at the same time by using these strong voice and strong opinions, but pairing it with facts and the reality of situations. My entire career as a journalist, I was told you can't be an advocate. That was definitely pivotal for me. And I did not go into education, but when I did my master's at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, now known as the Newmark Graduate School of Journalism, I loved it. I got asked to come back as an adjunct professor, and I have been there since 2018. I just moved to Texas, though, so unfortunately, I cannot teach in New York from Texas, so that job is over at the moment. But I was doing it since 2018 up until last year, and it was the most incredible, fulfilling thing. I think especially because I was working with adults in the master's program. It was just so wonderful to pass on some knowledge that I have and then watch these people take it and do something even better with it. I was not a person who was like, I'm going to make a true crime podcast. It came to me. I was doing DHS, ICE, and border reporting for a really long time. It was around 2016. I was working at NPR's Latino USA. I was called by a production company saying, hey, we found your name because you're a female journalist who went to UMass, and so did this missing person, Maura Murray. And I did know who Maura was because I've always paid attention to true crime. The genre of true crime was generally always part of my life. When all of those first shows were on back, when all those channels were coming about, I was watching them, and those were formative years for me. It was my early college years. Some of them back then were really terrible. The salaciousness was never what I wanted. I really liked watching Forensic Files and Unsolved Mysteries and the science and the facts of these things, because it was always procedural and I always wanted to understand crime and I wanted to understand how not to be a victim. And that was something from a very early age. Maura Murray was on an episode of Disappeared, one of the earlier episodes that I had seen. So I kind of just said, this seems like it's meant to be in a way. I really wanted to go back to doing border reporting and stuff, and I did for a minute. I kind of made this transfer from doing detention and ICE into prisons once I started working in true crime. The word true crime to me just feels so demeaning. I think for me, especially as a journalist who does focus mostly on the system, not necessarily the crimes themselves, just feels more true to say I'm a journalist in the criminal legal system. I find the facts and the truth of situations. And when I find these truths, which are often quite horrible and show how messed up our system is, how would I not use my platform to scream about these things that I'm finding with my investigations? That does make me an advocate. But at the same time, going into prison and meeting these people, that's a whole other form of advocacy that's very much looked down upon in journalism, because building these relationships, you can often be seen as subjective in your reporting. That's been difficult for me to navigate, but I think I'm getting better at it and more comfortable at just being like, yes, I have seen what these people go through. I've reported on the facts, and I have deep human compassion and empathy for them. And if that to you makes my reporting subjective, that's a you problem, because I'm still reporting facts. I can just see and feel and communicate the humanity of these people better than I think a lot of these suited up CNN reporters. And I've been told in the past by folks in prison, Hank Skinner is one who I specifically think of. He was on death row in Texas for a really long time, who had multiple stays of execution, who finally died of a brain tumor before he was able to be exonerated. Hank and I would talk only through letters. He never heard my voice. I never heard his voice except for interviews. He was not able to use the phone on Texas death row during this time. And he was a real dick to me in a lot of our communications. He just saw me as patronizing, like, I'm just going to swoop in here and help you. And when I finally went and met him and he saw me, I guess for listeners who don't know, I'm very tattooed and I have piercings and I don't wear blazers and suits. I wear Doc Martens and black t-shirts. When he saw me, he picked up the phone and was like, girl, if I knew this is who you were, I would have been a lot nicer to you. What I took that is he saw me as someone like him. He was covered in tattoos. I was covered in tattoos. He was talking about motorcycles and I was relating to him with my motorcycles. That's the kind of humanity I'm talking about in finding with these people and creating these connections. That's been difficult in the world of journalism to justify and navigate, but I think it's really important because Hank told me things and shared stories with me that he didn't with other people. In this world, someone might say to you, like, well, you shouldn't be reporting on this as a survivor. You're too close to the subject. And it's like, who better to understand survivors and what they're going through in a way that's not exploitative?
Thank you again to Cash App for sponsoring this episode.
Recently, I was talking to a loved one about a scary experience she had. She had splurged on what she thought was a great parking pass for a concert she had been waiting months to attend. But instead of receiving that parking pass, she had gotten scammed. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to get her money back, and everyone that she's told has been a lot more cautious with all of our online purchases since. That's why I love to share that when you get the Cash App card, not only do you get access to a ton of perks and benefits, like exclusive early access to nationwide concert presales or discounts on popular brands, but you also have extra security with the power to instantly lock or unlock your card right from your phone in just one tap. If a suspicious transaction pops up on your card, Cash App has your back by automatically declining the purchase and sending you a heads up to confirm if it's you or not. Behind the scenes, you can rest assured knowing your account balance is protected by 24/7 fraud monitoring. Spend with peace of mind today and order a Cash App card in the app or at cash.app/card. For a limited time, new Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use the code SECURE10 in their profile at sign up and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App's bank partners, prepaid debit cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC, discounts and promotions provided by Cash App, a Block, Inc. brand. Visit cash.app/legal/podcast for full disclosures.
I got into wrongful convictions after I did the reporting on Suave Gonzalez. I won the Pulitzer for the podcast Suave, which was about him. Was this one man's entire prison journey, his life journey, starting in the Bronx to prison to meeting with Joe Biden, to show this entire problem of what happens when we incarcerate a young person mandatorily for life. Suave is in prison for a crime he admits he did. I got really close with him and I learned so much through this man who did 30 plus years in prison and just became this incredible community figure. And I very quickly learned about redemption and how none of us are the worst thing we ever did or happened to us. He said to me one day, there's a lot of people in here, Maggie, who didn't actually do the crimes they're in here for. And I was like, what are you talking about? It's one of those things we think of. But at the time I was talking to him, there weren't all of these wrongful conviction shows or podcasts. Making a Murderer had just come out a couple years prior. Rabia was doing Undisclosed about Serial, and Bob Ruff was doing a podcast. There really wasn't much. And I just thought, here is this man that I care so deeply about who has turned his entire life around, deserves a second chance. And then I start thinking about these people who never did anything and are spending their lives in prison. One of the first people he told me about was this guy, Eddie Ramirez. He was doing time with in Pennsylvania. And years later, it all came full circle when I was doing the Wrongful Conviction podcast. I actually got to interview Eddie because he is out now. He really is the one that got me thinking about all of this. So that was really eye-opening for me. And I also thought about my own life, myself as a kid, just hanging out with the wrong people. Any misstep, I could have been in prison for life for allegedly doing something I did not do in particular. The stats about women in prison was something that I could not unsee, unhear, unlearn. The female prison population is growing exponentially. That's wrongfully convicted and rightfully convicted, I suppose, it was a way to put it. Most women in prison are mothers. So we're talking about an entire family system being destroyed by taking a woman and putting her in prison. Most are for petty crimes, drugs, stealing to help the kids. When it comes to wrongful convictions, one of the most shocking things is that most wrongfully convicted women are convicted for what's called a no crime crime. 71% of women exonerated in the last 3 decades were convicted of a no crime crime. So what that means is mostly babies, mostly children who had some sort of SIDS, maybe a seizure or something like that, fell out of their crib. And the mother is charged for killing the child. That's what most women who are wrongfully convicted are in prison for. And that is one of the most heartbreaking things I've ever seen. The compounding trauma and frustration. 2 cases I know of, the child was sick for years. And the mother was taking the baby to the doctor, and the doctor was saying, you're overreacting, your baby's fine. And then one day it just suddenly dies and she's in prison for killing her child. That's something that I can't forget about at all, is what wrongfully convicted women go through in prison. I've seen fathers too who are in prison for killing their own child. I'm going to specifically talk about wrongful convictions. One of the main things I see is economic status is huge. You could be any race, gender, ethnicity, and if you don't have money, you're screwed. The things that I see are people who in general are marginalized, whether it is class, race, income, education. It's folks who don't know their rights, who don't know to just say, I'm not talking to you, I want a lawyer. I think things like that are getting better. Going back to true crime as a genre is making jurors smarter. I think it's making police a little more rigid and thoughtful in how they're questioning folks. I think it has had really positive influences on society. And one of those that is a perfect example is the Karen Reed case. She's a privileged white woman, so she got a ton of media attention that someone else might not get. And she was able to hire really good attorneys. They were able to fight really hard. Most of these wrongful convictions happen because the defense was poor. That's the main thing I see, is people just having horrible defense attorneys, just not knowing their rights.
Yeah. Every time I share our story, I try to highlight the fact that I think that the reason why my brother was given every ounce of opportunity he has and continues to take the opportunity is because he's from Calabasas, which we know is a very wealthy area.
I love that you bring that up too, because I had a similar personal experience. My ex-partner about a decade ago became schizophrenic around 24. And I too had a very difficult time trying to get him some sort of help. Eventually it became having to call police because I was afraid. I do believe the struggle I had getting him any kind of help or getting officers to listen to me. He was constantly released when he should have been on hold. He was a blonde hair, blue eyed, very handsome man. Yeah, I think that he had a privilege that someone else may not have had in that situation.
Your work has become prolific, Pulitzer Prize winning, and you have now 6 podcasts. Do you want to talk more about the podcast projects that have come about from your experiences?
Yeah. So in the work I do, the stories I try to focus on, I want to be a microcosm of a bigger issue. I love focusing in on an individual human, an individual problem that is representative of this larger umbrella. I do have a podcast that just came out. It's called Bone Valley Season 3, Graves County. It's about power dynamics. And it is, yes, a wrongful conviction. It's about 5 people, actually, who were wrongfully convicted. One of them is still doing life in prison. But the show really focuses on what happens when we are so desperate for answers, when we are so desperate to get justice for a loved one who, in this case, was murdered, and how that can go so terribly wrong when we get this tunnel vision of just wanting answers. And the whole thing involves citizen sleuths and a BBC journalist and this whole town that was crazed for answers. And all of the answers that they got rested on these young women who were marginalized, disadvantaged. According to them, they were sex trafficked at young ages. And these are the young girls who were pressured by people in power to give answers that ultimately we discovered were lies. So that's the newest podcast I have out. This story that they convicted these 5 people on, how did you concoct that? And the answer is pretty shocking. Yeah, this is a wrongful conviction, but it's also about so many other things. Graves County is out, and there is a 2020 special out if you want to watch on the podcast Graves County. It's super exciting because they look into some things that we just didn't have the bandwidth to. This case is absolutely wild, multi-layered. I think it encompasses every aspect of the genre that people are interested in and want to learn about.
I'd love to hear your perspective of the power of the media and also what you would hope people that consume true crime media keep in mind while they do that.
One of the things with true crime is that I just think, well, people know it and it's said all the time. We just have to remember these are people. Yes, it's a story. Yes, the dark side of it is there are people who are producers who are looking and saying, is this a good story? I mean, that's what I do in my work. So I want people to remember that everyone featured is a human in this, whether they're the victim, survivor, or the perpetrator. We talk about this in Graves County, the quote, villain of the story. He was doomed from birth, his circumstances. I know some people don't like hearing or focusing on these perpetrators, but I think we just need to remember that everyone in this is human. And any one of us could have been a victim or survivor. And that's just what I think everyone needs to remember. I'm a Killer. It's a show where these people who are murderers tell their own story. And I haven't watched many episodes, but one episode I watched was called Pyro Joe. He was a kid who was poorly abused. When he was 17-ish, him and a couple friends went to rob a house and he murdered the woman. I found his story of abuse and just what happened to him so compelling. I wrote him and I became friends with Joe. He is the first person that is a convicted murderer that I felt compelled to reach out to, because that's not generally what I do. I think it's so interesting because in society, we don't want to hear from these people. They're terrible. Lock them away. But wait, what about people who are capable of reform? What about the people who should have a second chance? And I think that's kind of the thing that I try to do with a lot of these characters, is be like, it's just not so black and white. This person can be a fucking terrible murderer, but when he was a child, he lived in a box. Again, that's what I want people to remember. It's just everyone's human. I think to have humanity and compassion for everyone. And I'm just curious what you think about that with your brother.
Well, it's interesting because I think everything is a gradient. I agree with everything you've said, that most of us become who we are for many reasons. People ask me, why did he murder my mom? And I often say there is no one why. Everything doesn't happen for a reason. It happens for a million reasons. And there were a million reasons why. However, most of those reasons why were his pivot points, that he had a choice and he always made the wrong one. And he's continued to be a very, very highly dangerous man, although he had every opportunity to do better. I think his actions speak louder than his words. Half of the things he says are false, or maybe like 98% of them are false, and or it's abusive. So I worry about amplifying someone like him.
I agree with you as well. It's interesting the way that you speak about it, because I've just finished listening to a Carrie Rawson interview. She's BTK's daughter. It's so similar the way she speaks about him, and like when he gets out there and talks and has these lies and she has to deal with it. I 100% get that. It's all so different. And I think I recoil at people who say to me, why would you ever try to make us feel bad for this person? They're terrible. They're a killer. It doesn't matter. And I just think that's wrong, because how are we supposed to understand why they do things if we're not going to look at them with some sort of understanding or empathy?
Absolutely. I know the importance of the psychology of people who have perpetrated crimes, but I think that what true crime does as a genre, it generally focuses on that. My hope in true crime is to make the focus of the genre more the psychology of the victim who survived, or the co-victim who survived. The how and why is important. It's just, I'd like a balanced amount of information, if you will, and more first-person narratives from victims so they feel represented and heard.
I hear you. It's so interesting because I do feel like you and I often, maybe in our work, might come from different sides, different perspectives. And I think it's so cool that we can have a conversation like this and agree on the same things. Thank you for having me on, and thank you for doing the show, and thank you for being so vulnerable. Those of us that also do this work couldn't if people like you weren't vulnerable and shared their stories.
According to the West Virginia Innocence Project, quote, a wrongful conviction is when a person is convicted of a crime they did not commit and can occur at various stages of the criminal justice process, end quote. The organization goes on to explain that wrongful convictions are often attributed to five common causes. 1, eyewitness misidentification. 2, false confessions. 3, insufficient legal representation. 4, unreliable informant testimony. And 5, unreliable or improper forensic science. Recent studies show that as many as 3 to 6% of all incarcerated people in U.S. prisons were wrongfully convicted. The current U.S. prison population is around 1.2 million people, which means between 36,000 and 72,000 imprisoned people are currently wrongfully convicted. Since 1989, the National Registry of Exonerations recorded 2,645 exonerations in the United States as of 2020. Those exonerees have a collective total of 23,590 years lost in prison, with each person spending an average of 8.9 years in prison before release. In 2023 alone, nearly 84% of exonerees were people of color, and nearly 61% of exonerees were Black. For more information on wrongful conviction, please visit the Innocence Project at innocenceproject.org.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode.
Thank you again to Cash App for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget, for a limited time, new Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use the code SECURE10 in their profile at signup and send $5 to a friend within 14 days. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App's bank partners, prepaid debit cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC. Discounts and promotions provided by Cash App, a Block, Inc. brand. Visit cash.app/legal/podcast for full disclosures.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.